Howdy, partners. You're listening to Conversations with Jacob, hosted by my good friend, Jacob Waller. Make sure to check out the podcast where podcasts are available and check out the video version on YouTube. You can follow us on social media. Facebook is Conversations with Jacob. Twitter is at CWJ Podcast. And you can visit our website, conversationswithjacobpodcast.weebly.com. Hey, you got a show idea? Maybe a guest suggestion? Email us at conversationswithjacob@gmail.com. Now, here's your host, Jacob Waller.
And what's going on, everybody? And welcome back to another episode of Conversations with Jacob. And we got a special guest with us again. And who knows? And if you watched episode one, then you know who he is. But before we get to our guest, I would also check out Two Chairs, No Wait, an Andy Griffin fan podcast hosted by Adam Newsom, who was on the podcast last week. Check it out, Two Chairs, No Wait. Of course, you guys know about the social media, the email, the websites. So today is, today on the podcast is Mr. David Newell, who appeared on episode one of the podcast. David, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you. Here I am again. And speedy delivery, Jacob.
Speedy delivery. There you go. Yeah.
Now, that's a little hint. That's a little hint, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, people have demanded me to get you on for a part two. They said, Jacob, you know what? You got to do a part two with Mr. McFeely. I'm like, well, you know, I don't know what else to cover, but I'm sure that we're coming with something to talk about.
Okay. Well, do you have one question you can start with?
Yeah, sure. Now, growing up, and what was your life like?
My life growing up, it's interesting you would say that, because I was just writing an article about when I was growing up, they would advertise in newspapers movies. They don't do it anymore, but newspapers, that's how you got your news when I was growing up. The Sunday paper of the local Pittsburgh papers, they had three papers. You would turn to two pages and it'd be full of advertisements for movies. So I would get my scissors and I would cut out each ad. And this is during the 50s. And I would file each ad related to a specific movie into a file. And I was going through boxes yesterday or the other day, and I came across those, and I found them, and that was my misspent youth. Everybody was out doing something, and I was clipping. You know, in a way, I made it all work, because I think that gave me my interest in television, because television wasn't around that. Well, it was in the 50s, but it was very primitive. It was still in black and white, and I was still in movies, but movies were slowly eroding theaters and theater business. And it was a big change in the 50s. And to make a long story short, you asked me how I spent some of my youth. These were my teenage years. And I spent it cutting out movie ads and filing them. So if you want to know anything about 1950, 1960 movies, I have it right here in my file folder.
Now, when you was growing up, did you have a dream job that you wanted to do?
Yes, I did. As a young kid, I remember wanting to be in. I loved Abbott and Costello movies, and my grandfather would take me to see movies and stage plays, and I knew I wanted to be involved in some version of film. Television was not in the picture when I was growing up yet. And I wanted to be associated somehow with theater and films. And he would take me to local touring companies to see shows that were on tour, take me to movies. And that was my introduction. And I thought, you know, that'd be great if I could work backstage. My first interest was in the technical part of it. It still is. And high school, I didn't go to college right away. I worked for about a year. Then I went to a school here in Pittsburgh called the Pittsburgh Playhouse School of the Theater. It was an intensive course in theater and acting and directing, and it was so intense that I learned so much, and I took that knowledge, and as a result, when this job offer came to work with Fred Rogers on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood back in 1967, I was equipped. And I started as the technical person who was in charge of all the costumes and props, and I had to go out and find what we needed. And I had all this background in stage management and managing props for the shows, and I sort of slipped into it that way. In fact, I may have told you this in the last interview, but when I first met Fred Rogers, it was for about an hour, and I got a lead from a friend who set up a meeting with Fred Rogers and myself. And I met Fred, and he was looking for a person to work the props and costumes, etc. I talked to him for a whole hour, and I may have told you this too, but he didn't ask me anything about the job or my experience. He just talked to me. And at the end of the hour, he said, "Well, when can you start?" And I got the job. And to top it all off, I was ready to leave. And I said, "Oh, by the way," Fred said this, "I have the scripts here, and I've written in a part for a delivery man, and I want you to play that part too." And I said, "Boy, I sort of hit the jackpot. I've got a job, and my ancillary job would be playing Mr. McFeely." And here I am 50 years later.
So can you say that you was there since day one?
Yes. Well, day one for the present series. Now, I'll clarify that. The Fred Rogers started Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood in Canada. That's where it began, on the CBC. He had a program in Pittsburgh called the Children's Corner. It ran for 7 years. It was local. Somebody saw him working with children through television at the CBC and offered him to bring his program to the CBC, which he did. He stayed for about a year and a half, and then he wanted to come back to the States because I think his sons were ready to enter school, and he wanted them to go to school in the U.S. So he came back here, took the programs that he made in Canada, and bookended them with new intros and extros, and that went on the air. During that time, Sears Roebuck Foundation came along and they said, "We've seen what you've done. We'd like to take your program national." And that's when he hired a staff, and that's when I came aboard. So I didn't start from the very beginning of the original Mr. Rogers Neighborhood. I started when it went national on PBS. So for all intents and purposes, yes, I was on the very first program that went national. Let's put it that way.
Now, and what was your opinion or thoughts on when Fred Rogers told you about the idea of playing a delivery man?
Well, I said, "Well, that'd be fun." He said, "The reason he wrote in the delivery man was because in the previous Mr. Rogers that he made, he brought in each little prop or each whatever." He wanted to sort of enlarge the program and bring more cast members in. He said, "Instead of me bringing it in, I have written a part of the delivery man. He owns a company. It's called Speedy Delivery. And I want you to play that part." And oh, boy, I may have told you this too. But the original name of Mr. McFeely was Mr. McCurdy. Oh, yeah. And did I tell you that?
Yeah, I think so.
It happened to be for the new people who are coming along listening to this, it happened to be the name of the Sears Roebuck person who underwrote the program, Mr. McCurdy. And he was doing it in honor of that man. And the man said, "Oh, please don't do that. It looks like too self-serving for us." And Fred said, "Okay, we're getting him a new name. And your name now, David, is Mr. McFeely on the program." And as a matter of fact,
I was about to say the same thing. McFeely is also Fred's, I think, last name or middle name.
It's his middle name, and it was his grandfather. The real Mr. McFeely was his grandfather, and so he was named after his grandfather, Fred McFeely Rogers. And his grandfather was on his mother's side, so at any rate, McFeely was the middle name, and that was his mother's maiden name. That's how it came about. So it's his grandfather's name and his mother's maiden name, so it meant a lot to him, I think, and that's why he called me McFeely. It's a very common name around the Pittsburgh area. I guess it's Irish Scotch, and a lot of Irish and Scotch settled in the Pittsburgh area in the late 1900s. So, or the late 1800s, rather. So, anyhow, I'm Mr. McFeely.
Now, and what was the first day of, the first day of, of filming, and what was that like?
The first day of filming or taping, you mean?
Yeah, well, yeah.
Well, I don't know if I told you that story, but it stopped me if I did. I know. That's when he told me my name was McFeely. I was in my costume ready to go, but I had all the props ready. I had the puppets were all set. Everything was ready for to tape our first program. And he came up to me and said, "We have to get you another name," because he just heard that McCurdy wouldn't do. "So you're now Mr. McFeely." And he said, "Okay, we start taping in 20 minutes. And my first delivery was a animal. It was a... It was an animal that he wanted to show the children. It was a possum. And I had gotten it from the Pittsburgh Zoo, and I, as the prop man, and then I changed my hat into the delivery man on the program and made a delivery, and I came in and we showed, and they got close-ups. We talked about the animal and so forth. And then he always made it a point to let children know that animals need to be taken care of, and how well the zoo took care of their animals. And if you have an animal at home, you know, it needs to have good care. And that was always a point that he wanted to make about animals. So we went through, that was about a 10-minute segment. That was the first segment I did. And the time was up, and I have to get the animal back to, the zoo, Mr. Rogers, and I'll see you around. And I packed him up and went to the door, and I turned around and said to Fred, "Well, speedy delivery." And that's how it stuck. And he said, "Speedy delivery, Mr. McFeely." And here I am. That's my catchphrase.
So you was playing two roles, because you was Mr. McFeely and also the prop guy.
Yeah. Pardon me. Yeah, I was both.
Yeah, both. Yeah.
Yes, I was the prop guy. When I wasn't in every program, but I was in charge of getting all the props and costumes for the program. And if I happened to be on the program, I had to do all of that and then get into my costume and be Mr. McFeely. So it was, we were busy. You know, in that first year, it was, let's see, our season was 1967. September 67 to June or July of 68, we did 130 programs within that time period. We were very busy, and I got all the props. I got all the costumes. McFeely was in a lot of those programs, and it was my first introduction to television as a performer / production coordinator. Yeah, I was busy, but I loved every minute of it. I wouldn't trade it for anything. And I thought then, well, I have a job for 1 year. And here I am, 50 years later talking to you, and I'm still involved with Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
Now, when you, when they filmed an episode of Mr. Rogers, and how many episodes did they film in a day?
Well, it depends on how intricate they were. What we did first, we did all the location shoots first. If there was a factory film, for instance, we were showing children how they made cereal, for instance. We'd go to the factory and the process would be shown. That would be first. Then we do the neighborhood of make-believe where the puppets are. and we would see how long that episode would take. Then he would have the timing for the opening and closing, and we would do those last. So we could do about 3 programs in a week. It took us about a week. It would take us about, if he wanted to do 30 programs, it would take us probably, 3 or 4 months to do 30 programs. So, but we did it in sort of movie style, and movie style means that they maybe tape out of order, and we did. We never did a program as you see it on television all the way through. We did it maybe backwards. Well, not totally backwards. We worked from the inside out is a better description. We would have the inner workings of the program, the locations in the neighborhood of Maple Leaf. Say that took 20 minutes, so then Fred would know he had 10 minutes to do the opening and closing. That's how we worked.
Now, what some people don't know is that Fred also did the voices of the puppets.
He did. He did most of them. He did King Friday, the popular ones. He did King Friday, Lady Elaine, Henrietta the Cat. He did X the Owl. He did Daniel Tiger. And he did most of them. There were a few other puppeteers who helped him, but Fred did the main puppets. In fact, the main puppets that were on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood were introduced during the Children's Corner years, the local program that he had in Pittsburgh. King Friday goes all the way back to April 1st, 1954. That's when King Friday appeared on the Children's Corner, which was a live hour show daily from Pittsburgh. Now, over the years, King Friday, the puppet, the name remained the same, but the puppet was upgraded somewhat. It went from more of a cloth puppet to more of a standard hand puppet as you see now. But Fred did all the voices.
Now, did he do all the voices? Was all the way up until the last episode?
Yes, of all the main puppets. Yeah, all the ones he did that he started out with, he did for all of the programs. Yes. Wow. And we did over 1,000 programs over the years, plus the ones he did in Canada and the ones he did locally on the Children's Corner. So it was really Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. He wrote the music. He wrote the lyrics. He did the puppets' voices. He wrote the scripts. He hosted it. And it was Fred Rogers' Neighborhood. And I was so proud to be a part of that and help him tell those stories. It was really rewarding.
Did you or Mr. Rogers ever think the show would become as big as it is now?
No, I didn't. I think the first year, I don't think, maybe some people think that way, but I didn't. I thought, well, this is great. I've got a job for a year. It's a program that is really something that is worthwhile and should be on television. It's something that benefits children. It's good. It's wholesome. And I'm glad I'm associated with it. So that's what I was thinking. And then at the end of that year, the end of the season, we finished 130 programs. The producer at the time, Fred had him call me and said, Fred wants you to come back for the second season. And from that point on, we did 65 half hours a season from till we wrapped up in 2000, something like that. But from that point, from 2003 and now, the reprograms are being repeated. Somewhere today, you can see a Mr. Rogers Neighborhood program because it's on pbskids.org. You can go to computer and they're up. There's an app. You can get a PBS Kids app. You can watch Mr. Rogers Neighborhood whenever you like. So the programs we made when I was taking the possum back to the zoo, that's even on there, I think.
Since you've worked on almost all the episodes, do you got a favorite episode that you worked on?
Oh, boy. They were all favorites. But, yes, I do have one. I have one or two or more than that. But the one that really stands out is, and I may have told you this, too. I can't remember. you know who Margaret Hamilton is, the Wicked Witch of the West and in Wizard of Oz. Well, our daughter at the time when we started the program was about 3 years old, and she was watching The Incredible Hulk one evening by chance, and it scared her. And she had nightmares. And then people would tell me, boy, I still have nightmares. When I was little, I watched The Wizard of Oz, and it scared me, and I still am afraid of that witch. And I thought to Fred, you know, Fred, wonder if we could take potentially scary images like the witch and the Hulk and put them in perspective for young children. And he said, I remember, he said, if you can find Margaret Hamilton, the actress, I'll write the script. And I found her. She was touring in a musical. And as a matter of fact, it was called Little Night Music, which was the touring company of the Broadway show. And I located her manager. One thing led to another. And she said, I'd love to be able to come on the program. In fact, I watch Mr. Rogers. She lived in New York City. I love Mr. Rogers. I watch him with my grandchildren. So she came on, and we had a witch's costume. And she said, you see, I'm an actress. I'm not a scary witch. I'm a good person. And here's the costume I wear, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it really broke down the potential scary images. And children saw that it was pretend. And she described it as like a Halloween costume, and that it was her job. And it was her job to be an actress. She explained all of that. And we had letters from parents afterwards, after that episode. She says, thank you so much. It really helped our children explain scary images like witches. And not all witches are scary, but a lot of the programs you see have witches and other. The Hulk, for instance, is scary to a lot of young children. We wanted to demystify that and show that it's pretend. And that was a favorite program. And we did the same thing with the Hulk, too, Incredible Hulk. Right. I don't know if did I tell you that story before?
I can't remember. I don't think so.
We invited Lou Ferrigno to come on the air because my daughter was frightened by the costume that he wore, you know, and how Bill Bixby, if you remember, Bill Bixby was the actor who, when he got angry, he burst into a monster and it became Incredible Hulk, et cetera. And he green hair, green eyes, and all of that. So we went to the Universal Studios to watch them tape a episode of Incredible Hulk. And before that, or during their taping, they had a lunch break. And we had Lou Ferrigno come and talk to Fred about his feelings about making the program. And we went, before we did that, now that I think of it, we started taping when he was getting into his makeup. He walked into the makeup trailer as Lou Ferrigno, and we had a camera there showing the prosthetics going on his nose, his forehead, putting all the green makeup on him. And it was showed, it was like a Halloween costume, and that really helped a lot of kids. When my daughter saw it, by the time she saw it, we made that, she was about four at that point, and she understood that that scary, I thought that was just, that man was like that all the time, you know. Kids, young children don't separate fantasy and reality. To them, it's all one thing, you know. As they get older, they understand that The Incredible Hulk is an actor. But preschoolers don't understand that. They think it's the real thing right there, and it scares them. It's good to be able to break those scary images down for young children, and that's what Fred did.
Do you think that's why he kind of covers some controversial stuff on his program?
We did cover some controversial stuff. One being a week on divorce. You know, we get a lot of letters, and people would write in and say what they enjoyed, but they also said, do you think you could do this or do that? And one of the most common comments that we got in letters was, do you think that you could, this is directed to Fred Rogers, do you think you could do something about divorce? That's happening in our family. It's happened to our friends' family. Our children talk about their friends. No, it's, and it seemed like it was happening a lot, and I guess it still does. Well, it does. And I think in some ways, it's good to be able to help children with that the best we can. So how Fred did it, there was a Sunday evening. We did a week on divorce. The whole week was dedicated to that. And it's hard to explain the storyline, but we started off with a studio audience discussion, like a Phil Donahue show, you know, a live show, and the studio audience would be there, like an Oprah show. And Fred had a couple of people on who are experts in divorce and how they counsel people going through divorce and so forth. And it was an hour discussion with audience questions. The next day, on Monday, the week on divorce started on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and it helped parents maybe prepare to sit with their children and watch that week of program. That's an ideal, couldn't happen all the time, but that's how we designed it. But also it was designed to let children know that it's something that happens in families, and it's good to be able to talk about that. That was sort of Fred. He wanted to be able to let children know that it's good to have conversations about anything that could be troubling. And it's and that week, I believe, is on the week of 400 episodes that are available on pbskids.org. But if your viewers and listeners want to see it, they can search for it on that online and watch it, because it's an excellent week. And it's so hard for me to describe that whole week to you right now, but what it was intended to do, as other difficult subjects, was be able to, Fred always said, what is mentionable is manageable. And that makes a lot of sense if you think about it. If you can mention something and talk about it, it can be manageable. It might not be easy, but it can be manageable. And that was why he did a lot of those subjects. He did one on superheroes too. His, you know, Lou Ferrigno talking about pretending. And we did one on going to the doctor for the first time and going to the hospital. It's potentially frightening for young children who are maybe going in for tonsils. They don't know what to expect. So we tried to do these series to help them in the best way we could.
Do you remember the episode that he did, Owen? It was him and a black man on the show. They both put their feet in a swimming.
Oh, yes. Francois Clemens was a regular on the program. And at the time, Fred remembers, this was done probably originally. It was done twice. Originally, the first part of the series back in the, I guess, late 60s, very early 70s, when there were a lot of pools that were still segregated. A lot of public pools were segregated. And Fred, you know, very subtle, he didn't mention anything about segregation, anything. He had Francois Clemens, the black policeman who stopped by for a visit to say hello. Fred happened to have a wading pool with his feet in it. And he said, join me. Join me, Francois. Rest your weary feet. You've been on your feet all day. Rest your feet. And they had a conversation with their feet in the waiting pool. And we did that early on, and then they repeated it towards the end of the series too. And it got a lot of good feedback. And you know, he didn't do it. That was Fred. His lessons were very subtle. And he didn't say anything about any segregation. And, you know, he did it by inviting Francois, his neighbor and friend, to sit down, relax your feet while you're on the policeman beat around the neighborhood. And that was a lesson. And that was Fred Rogers' way of dealing with various subjects. And in some ways, there's an expression that he always used his child development teacher, or somebody he studied with early on. He studied child development and music and also theology, and all of those disciplines worked together when he wrote the scripts. But his teacher of child development said, don't forget the fun. Now, you can have all these serious situations and serious information you want to give to children, but don't forget the fun. That's the most important thing, the fun of being a child and being able to learn. Learning is fun, too. And he wanted children to be able to be open to things and enjoy learning. If that makes sense to you, I think I'm making a point. But there are so, and I'm trying to condense Fred's philosophy into a few words here, and it's not easy because Fred was so schooled in child development. He knew what made children tick because he studied children. Oh, this is an example. She now still works for the program, but her name is Hedda. And Hedda graduated from college and came to in Pittsburgh and came to Fred. This is early on, and wanted to get into children's television. And Fred said, you know, my best advice for you is go and learn about children. And at the time, and still they still do, the University of Pittsburgh has a child development course, a two-year course that you can take about the development of a young child into adolescence. And she did. She took the two-year course. And I think Fred thought, well, I hope I gave her good advice. She came back after the course was over. She graduated. It was really a master's degree. And Fred hired her. And she still worked for the program. And she did. She took Fred's advice and learned about the development of a young child. And Fred uses a lot of that theory in Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, or did, and still, well, uses it. He still does, because the programs are still on and people are learning from them.
Now, I think you told me last time that they film the Make-Believe Land and the other scene in the same studio.
Yes, yes. It's all done in one studio. There's a studio in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and it's a studio of a public television station in Pittsburgh called WQED. That's a PBS station also. And they show the regular PBS programs, but they also have a production center there too. And that's where we made Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And there's three studios. There's a big studio, Studio A, which is now, by the way, called the Fred Rogers Studio in honor of Fred, because that's where we made, I would say, 98% of the program. There's a few smaller studios we would do some smaller sets in. But basically, how we did it was the first day of taping, we would have the filming for the drop-ins all done, the visits to the factory or something. They would be done. The Neighborhood of Make-Believe would be set up, and we do all the Neighborhood of Make-Believes maybe for a month. And then that set would be taken down in the interior where he comes through the door. That set would be set up, and we'd do all the openings and closings. And then that would be done, and the editor would take it from there. The editors would put all those together, and we'd have a month's worth of programs. So, and they were sent off to PBS to be aired. So we were just making them, and this was when the program was on with new programs. We would make them, and there would be a time lapse, and they'd have to edit, and they'd have to be at PBS in time to get on the air. And so it was we couldn't miss too much, or we'd fall behind. But yes, they were all done in the same studio, but the sets had to be changed. We couldn't put the entire set up, the Neighborhood of Make-Believe and the interior, at the same time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now, what is your thoughts on the movie that Tom Hanks did about Mr. Rogers?
Oh, I liked it. I thought Tom Hanks got the essence of Fred Rogers. He did. You know, you knew it was Tom Hanks, you know, but you at times forgot that it was Tom Hanks and you saw his version of Fred Rogers. I think he did a very good job of getting the essence of Fred out. He did a lot of his homework too. There's a college near Pittsburgh called St. Vincent's College, and they have a Fred Rogers library there, archives. That's what the word I'm looking for. It's where all of the tapes are and all of Fred's writings and so forth. And it's open to the public, by the way, too. And if you want to research Fred Rogers or children's television, you can, and it's online. You look for the Fred Rogers Center, and you can find their posting. Where was I? You asked me.
About the Tom Hanks movie.
Oh, yeah, the Tom Hanks. So Tom Hanks came 2 months before I think the movie was due to film, and spent a day at the center in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, where Fred was born. Actually, he was born in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, and St. Vincent's College is located there. And Tom Hanks had the curator show him speeches and photos and some tapes of the program, and really studied Fred Rogers. And he took all that in, and I guess he took some information with him. And then 2 months later, they came back and they started filming the, it's called Won't You Be My Neighbor? I think this month, one of the streaming services has it on. You can still see it. And I have a cameo in it too.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. There's a scene right at the end of the movie where the producer wanted this. There's a restaurant scene where Tom Hanks and the man who played the writer, whose name is Matthew Reese, that's the actor's name, excellent actor, and they were having a conversation, and as that happened, Tom Hanks, as Fred Rogers, said, "Now think of the people who helped you as you were growing up," a line something like that, and the camera at that point panned around the restaurant, and there we were. Mrs. Rogers was there, Fred's wife, and myself, and Hedda, the person who Fred advised to study children, and Bill Eisler, who was the company president, and his wife, and Margie Whitmer, who was the producer of the. We were all at the table in the restaurant, and the camera panned by us. And as if it was a tribute, it was the audience wouldn't know that, but yeah. The producer of the film wanted to get a little cameo in of all of us who helped Fred all those years. So that it was a tribute to us.
Oh yeah, well, I'm going to look out for that. How the next time I watch it?
Yeah, dude, it's at the end of the film, but in the course of the film. There's also a scene of Fred taping a program with Tom Hanks of Fred, and there's a McFeely, an actor who's playing McFeely too. And that's not me, but that's the actor playing McFeely. But what was I also? Yes, that's what I wanted to say. And they taped a lot of it in the studio where we taped Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and they recreated the set. And I walked into the studio before they were taping, and the set was up that they made, not ours. They made, and I couldn't tell the difference. It was like deja vu, whatever they call that. It was like time warp. There was the set. It looked just like it did all those years we were taping. And now they've donated that set that they used in the movie to the Heinz History Center in Pittsburgh. There's a center in downtown Pittsburgh called the Heinz History Center, Heinz Ketchup, that's the Heinz company. And they have a museum devoted to Pittsburgh related treasures, I would say. and the Mr. Rogers set is in that museum, along with a lot of the Steelers memorabilia. And if you're ever in Pittsburgh, if your viewers are ever in Pittsburgh, I would look up the Heinz History Museum and see a lot of the national, because the Steelers are a national football team, really. And there's Steeler mementos there, as well as Mr. Rogers mementos, as well as a lot of Pittsburgh history in the Heinz History Center. So there are two places that viewers can go to visit. One is the Heinz History Center, downtown Pittsburgh. The other is the one I mentioned before, the Fred Rogers Center on the campus of St. Vincent's College in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. And that has some of the puppets, the original puppets, and it has all of the scripts, and you can do research there. The one in Pittsburgh is more a museum where you see what was used on television. The one in St. Vincent's is more for research and study.
So, and where did the original set go? Does it still exist?
That's the one. That one is what's in the Heinz History Museum, the original set. The one they used in Tom Hanks' film, that set, is in the lobby of WQED. They donated a lot of the pieces that they used in the movie to the public television station. So there are pieces of the Tom Hanks movie at the WQED studios, but the original Mr. Rogers set that we used is at the Heinz History Center. Oh. Does that make sense? Did I clear that up?
Yeah. So now I've seen something recently, and maybe you know what I'm talking about, which I didn't read at all, but I've seen a picture of you online. I think you got some kind of
medal.
Medal, yeah.
It was a medal, and I was so honored. It was a medal from the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, and it's in fact it's called, and I'll tell you exactly what it's called. It's called the Emmy Gold Circle Award, and it's for being in children's television for 50 years. And I just picked it up about a month ago, right before Christmas. They had a celebration in Los Angeles. And there were other people who got some other awards too, but I got the 50-year Gold Circle Award. And there was another person from our company, the Fred Rogers Company, who'd been in children's television for 25 years, and she got one for 25 years in children's television. And then there were other people there too. I know, and I remember sitting at a table at the reception for the for the award ceremony with SpongeBob. he was there too, and he nice man, Tom Kenny's his name, and he was a big fan of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood and still is. But he was there because, again, it was a children's television evening. But that's what I got. It was called the Gold Circle Award, and I was so proud to get it because of my 50 years working in Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood and continuing. In fact, about 3 weeks, I go to Michigan for a conference speaking to autism, a conference on autism, as me, David Newell, who played Mr. McFeely. I don't go as Mr. McFeely, but I go. So I'm still talking about Fred Rogers' work at different conferences around the country. And in April, we go to Hedda and Margie, our producer, we go to Florida, Winter Park, at Rollins College, has a week on kindness. And that's the college that Fred attended, Rollins College in Winter Park, Florida, near Orlando. And we're going to go there for our second week of kindness. And we have speeches and different events through that whole week talking about television and how you can be used for the good, and using Fred as an example of using television for teaching and caring messages, and that's what that week is. And on kindness, you know, Fred was in real, he was the kindest person I had ever met. Really, it was not an act. He was the real thing. You couldn't be Fred Rogers. You couldn't duplicate that. He was the real thing. And that was such an honor to work with someone who was so kind, so smart. He was a very, and what people didn't know about him, he was so funny. He had a great sense of humor, and it came out in some of the puppets too. But Fred was a great appreciator. You could tell him a story or a joke or something, and he would be right with you. He would just focus on that person. He was a very, very special man and the real thing.
Now, what do you remember from the last day of filming?
Oh, boy. It was a hard day. And I was trying to be nonchalant about it, but it was hard. I know. Here's what I do. I was in the, there was a, the last week of taping, the last week that we taped, I should say, I was in several programs. But the last one I was on, I think it was a Thursday or Friday program, I can't remember, which would have been the last original program that we made. I had a scene with Fred at the opening of the show, and I made a delivery, and we showed the film, and he took the film out of the picture-picture, you know, where it shows the films, and he handed us, thank you, Mr. McFilley, thank you for showing me that film that you made, and I was supposedly made the film. Actually, the photographer that we on staff made it, but so he handed it back to me, and normally I would just say, okay, I'll see you around the neighborhood and leave. But that day, I did it for myself. You couldn't tell unless I pointed it out to you. I shook his hand as if to say thank you for all these years. I want to do that for myself. I don't think he even realized it when I was shaking his hand. I just did it as, you know, a thank you, and I'll be on my way now. But I did it because I wanted something in that week, our last week, to say thank you, really thank you, Fred, for all these years. And that's what I did in the last taping that I was on. I think that was a Thursday. It could have been a Friday program. I'm not sure. And then I shook his hand and said, see you around the neighborhood. And I exited for the last time. And that was it. That was the last week of taping. And that's on, too. That's, and I can't remember the numbers, but that is on the series that you can get on pbskids.org.
Now, how was the last time that you saw Fred? And was it during that taping, or was it?
No, that was in, we finished in, that was about 2000, I think, we finished taping the program. Fred passed away in 2003. So he was around, you know, we were in the office, we did trips, we were still doing events. He would still be doing speeches, and I would accompany him on when he would go for interviews too. Excuse me here. I'm tearing up a little bit. But my job is PR, my PR hat, not my McFeely hat. When he would go to do a speech, he did a lot of graduation speeches for colleges and would do the keynote graduation speech, and a lot of the colleges would give him honorary degrees. So it was my job sort of set that up and plan the trip and make sure we had the hotels and the everything, and then I would go with him to sort of run interference and help him while he was there, because when you're there as Fred, he was so popular, he needed someone to be there and help him say, well, we have to go now, Fred, etc. Sort of usher him along, and that's what I did for those years. But he got very ill probably in the early part of 2003. He really became very ill and cut back a lot, spent a lot of time at home. He was in the hospital for a while and came out, and I think he had stomach cancer, and I think they think they he I think they think, the doctors, that they had gotten it, but it came back up again, and that's what he died of, was stomach cancer. And that was the last time I saw him, was probably a few weeks before he passed away, and he was at home at that point. And talked to him, of course, on the phone a lot. But you know what remains is all those many years of programs that we did. And I remember the first time that we had a meeting before we started taping, he said, you know, what I want to do with these programs is make a library of Mr. Rogers' programs so they can be used for generations to come. And that's what's happening. You know,
yeah.
Children today see Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood maybe as often as they did back when it was on, because now it's available on online, and you can see it anytime. Of course, there's a lot of competition now too. When we were doing the program, there was three networks, a public network, and maybe independent. Now there are 500 programs for a competition, but the neighborhood still resonates with families with young children. It is still something that Fred planned for. He wanted to make a library of important subjects for young children, like we were talking about earlier about the divorce. And, you know, children are always going to go through some sort of separation trauma if there's a divorce in the family. We did a week on death, talking about the death of a goldfish. As he used the goldfish as an example, but the purpose was to talk about that. And it's so hard to relate. I can't sum it up in 10 words here, but it's a very sensitive program. One of the classic Mr. Rogers programs, if you've never seen it. And if that's available too, if your family's going through a death in the family, a grandparent or an uncle or something, it's a program to maybe consider watching. Now, you know, and Fred knew at the same time he was making the program that, you know, I'm making them and I hope people can use them. That's how he said it. He wasn't saying this is going to be a cure-all for everybody. That was not, he wanted to say, here is my way of maybe helping families deal with separation, deal with divorce, deal with death, and I hope you can use them. He wasn't saying, I know everything. That was not his purpose at all. He wanted to say, okay, I hope you can use this program that I've thought about and made, and I hope it's helpful. That was Fred. He never thought that he had the last word. He thought he had a word to be able to give his interpretation. And if it's helpful to your family, fine. In fact, there was a week on divorce that we talked about, and we got letters saying that my child never thought of it. Now they think that we're going to get divorced. And you know, that I guess that's a risk you take. But if that parent could think about what the child has asked and deal with it on their own level. Now, I can see the frustration of somebody saying that. And yeah, I can see that. But that was not, Fred wanted to be helpful. And maybe in a way that was helpful. You know, that family, he was always hoping that children would turn off the program after it's over and think about what was just said. Now, that's an ideal. Not all children are going to do that. But ideally, why not try for that? And I was hoping the parents could watch at the same time, too, watch Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood with their children, because there could be a lot of discussion afterwards. There could be a lot of discussion about the divorce, about the loss of a goldfish, about separation anxiety, about going to school for the first time, which he did a whole week on that. When you stop to think of it, that's a big, big step for a young child, leaving home. Now, there's preschool now. But still, going to preschool and leaving home for the first time at three or four, for many kids can be traumatic, or at least, if nothing else, not knowing what to expect. And Fred would set that up. He would say, here's a typical day in a school. Here's the schoolroom. Here's this. Here's that. Here's the school bus. We did a whole week on going to school just to show children some basic things that we as adults would take for granted. But a young child getting on the school bus the first time with 50 other kids, that's a big move. You know, and he dealt with that. And that all came from his understanding of preschool and young children. That is the important, when you're working with young children, especially preschoolers, to know something about children is valuable. You know, if you're going to write a book about children or make a television program for and about children, you should know something about them and how they react to certain, and do some studying. And I think I have a master's degree after working with them for all these years. And I took courses in child development when I was in college. And the irony is that I got my job with Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood before I was out of college. I went to the University of Pittsburgh, and it was right across the street, conveniently, from the studio. So we was done taping at 5:30. I'd run over and do classes. And I took classes in psychology and child development, but my major was in English Lit. And that helped me with how putting a story together, too. And so I learned a lot by going to Pitt and working with Fred and seeing what I learned in the classes play out.
Now, if
anybody's watching or listening and wants to go into children's television, my advice would be, yes, do so. But try to learn a little about children. Take some courses on child development and child psychology and observe children to play. You can learn so much by going to a kindergarten class, a preschool class, and watch children as they play. Don't interact with them, just watch them, and you'll learn a lot.
Now, David, we come to the end of the episode here.
Okay.
But before I let you go, I always ask my guests if they got a closing thought. Do you got a closing thought for the people out there in the podcast land?
Oh, the podcast level. I think I maybe have just said it this last hour, and I think I could just sum it up to say, again, if you're going to work with children, no matter where, but especially in television, I think, or to learn something about children, that would be my advice. A lot of people want to get into children's television. So learn something about what makes them tick. I don't know if does that make sense? It makes sense to me.
Oh, yeah, it makes sense. Absolutely, yeah.
Now you can go and you can study and get a master's. You can study child psychology for 4 years and get a master's in it, too, and that's ideal, of course. But if you're just going into children's television and you need some background, you can at least take courses in child development just to learn about what makes them tick, because boy, a preschooler is so different from a 8, 9, 10, 12 year old. You know, the developmental process is so different as a preschooler and as a going into first and second grade. But I think our program covers preschoolers through about first and second. But you know something? We're coming to the end, but this is an interesting thought, that we get a lot of letters. We got a lot of letters from teenagers who remember fondly watching Mr. Rogers as a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old. Now, here they are going into teenagehood. And that is, you know, being a teenager, you can probably remember all this, is not an easy time. and neither is preschool, but they look back on the times they were watching Mr. Rogers and feeling very comfortable, home and cozy and watching Mr. Rogers. And they, as a teenager, they think back to those times. It's sort of, it's permissible regression in a way. that's the name of Fred's song. He has a song called Permissible Regression. It's okay to think about what's happened in the past. But I think that would be some advice I'd like people to know, is to that how much Fred respected children in childhood. And I think you can tell that when you watch any episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and that's what's important. They catch that.
One more thing.
There was one of Fred's teachers says, told him that, remember, attitudes are caught, not taught. If you love what you're doing, as an example, Fred went to observe preschool class, and there was a sculptor who came in with clay. He didn't say anything. He just put the bunch of clay down in front of this table, round table full of about 10 kids, and started to make a sculpture, some little horse or something. And from that point on, the sculptures and the figurines and little items the children would make out of clay were so much more sophisticated than they had done before the sculpture came into the class. And here's where attitudes are caught, not taught. They saw how much this sculptor loved doing what he was doing. They saw his love for that clay. And they caught that. In other words, his attitude was caught, not taught. He wasn't saying, now here's what you do. You do this and you mix that. No, he was doing it from his love of sculpture. Therefore, they caught his attitude. And that's what I'm saying, that children can catch from teachers too. I think children know teachers who love and respect them, and teachers who should be teaching some other place or doing another job. I think children can do that, and they can tell that. Teaching is a hard job, yes, and not every day is perfect. I give all of that, understand all of that. And anyway, right, I'm rattling on, and you're in the minute hand is moving around the clock, and we've talked a long time.
Oh, yeah, and it was great catching up with you. People always kind of own me like a dog on a raccoon, saying, do a part two, do a part two. I said, all right. So we've done the part two.
Well, here's part two. And, there's more for part three if you ever want to do it. So at any rate, in the meantime, Jacob, thank you very much for listening to all of my stories. I hope I didn't run you out of tape or whatever they use now. Out of digital or whatever. So, okay, now before we close, I think we did this last time too. I'm going to count to three.
All right.
And we're both going to say, guess what? Speedy. Here we go. And people at home can do this too. One, two, three.
Speed delivery.
See you, Jacob.
All right.
Bye-bye.